There we are, Rasputia. And we got Rasputia's brother here this morning. Got Mashianisefuti. How's it, Mash?
I'm good.
Mash is such a vibe, says Jerry Cursor. I had a good chuckle at the first hour. Yeah, Mash is always good fun. It's always nice catching up with him.
I'm glad.
Yes. All right. And we're very proud of you for losing weight, for being single again, for running the office because everybody thinks you're a genius because you use ChatGPT and none of them know what it is.
Yep.
Look at this. These are life hacks courtesy of Mash. All right. You want to get your life in order? This is the man to talk to.
Life is not that difficult, people. Just ChatGPT it out.
And ChatGPT is amazing.
It is. It makes life so easy.
So we're working on an AI model that has the tone of this show. So it's basically like my voice, effectively. So this will eventually be able to respond to queries, questions. Yeah. We can put templates together, effectively write bios for guests in my tone of voice, be able to put, and people won't know the difference. I think that's amazing. It means I don't have to sit there and they ask me, how do we do this? What do we have to do here? No, just ask the Gareth Cliff AI thing and it'll figure it out for you.
What are you going to call it? Because so far the AI is coming out. The names are so gack, like Twitter was Grok.
Okay, what should we call it?
Call it like Mashy or something. I don't know.
No, you just want to give it your name. That's beautiful. All right. Very good. So people are busy giving Mapelo a bit of advice here on lending people money. But listen, like Mash was telling us about that uncle earlier, there are always going to be people in your life. I once lent money to a friend of mine. She was going through a really, really rough time. Her dad had just died. She didn't have any cash. And I gave her a fairly substantial amount of money, but I gave it to her as a gift. So I knew I was never going to get that back. Yeah. It wasn't a loan. It was a gift. And as a result, I didn't expect it back. So we're still friends.
Yeah. But did she pay it back?
No, she never paid it back. Okay. And she's doing really well now. I don't expect it back. It was just a generous thing that I felt like doing at the time. But those occasions are rare.
Yes.
I don't think you should be helping other people. Not with big amounts of money.
Yeah.
Even, look, family, maybe you can make an argument for it. But then the extended family, like uncles?
No.
Right?
Uncles and aunts, never.
Never.
Rakhadi, never. No. Don't give them money.
Rakhadi?
Yeah. Unless you don't want to see that money.
The Rakhadis are a big problem, hey?
They are. They are. All of them. I don't know what happened. Maybe when God was making the Rakhadis, he was like, I don't know. Because we're going to have a problem here. I must make a problem here. Man. I don't know. But
that's so great.
They're just a problem. And shame, and my aunt.
Yeah.
My Rakhadi is not too much of a problem, thank goodness.
Yeah, good.
But one thing I was...
Because you've just lost contact with the rest of the family thanks to this show.
Good
but
riddance.
But at least you're keeping this aunt on side.
Oh, yeah, yeah. My aunt.
She's nice. You like her?
I love my aunt.
And she doesn't ask you for money?
She has... she has like once or twice. But a small amounts. For me, any amount below, I'd say 500 rand, depending on who you are and how close you are to me.
Sure.
Like the closer you are to me, then we can shift it up to maybe 1,000 rand.
Okay.
But the further you are from me, then 500 rand and downwards. That's an amount I'm willing to write off. Because 500 bucks, I'm like, it's like a quarter tank in my car. So it's fine. You can just keep it.
Bitcoin Boot says he just tells people he doesn't have money, which is also true. You just have to say, hey, listen, I don't have any.
But now, you know how that can come bite you in the back. Is that I used to be that person, like, guys, I don't have money all the time, and I don't have money. Then people started making plans without me because they're like, forget Mesh, never has money. Yeah, forget about it. He never has money. That's what ends up happening. It ends up working against you.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got friends too, and you know they can't afford something, so you don't invite them.
Yeah. But in reality, they can. They just never want to borrow you money.
Shame. Shame, that is rough.
That's the sad reality of it, Gareth.
Azalea says her in-laws are professional leeches, next level.
Ooh, okay.
They're just asking for money all the time.
Hippo.
I don't know. I mean, you can't win with some people. They are leeches.
Okay,
so let's take a look at this. Mash has also discovered that surnames were not a thing until the 1400s. In fact, even later than that, people used to be called, in Europe and in Africa, they were like called Mash, for example, from somewhere.
Oh.
So you would have been Mash from Klokstorp.
I remember, I think I saw it on Game of Thrones, like Mash of Klokstorp.
That's right, Mash Gareth of Klokstorp. Exactly.
Of Centurion.
Exactly. Ah. So that's what people would have said. And that was your surname.
What?
Except where it started happening, like I think the Jews would go Ben for like son of.
Okay.
And in Scandinavia, like you still have people who are called Johnson because their father's John, son of John.
Son of,
Johnson.
Yeah. What?
Yeah. And Svensson. So son of Sven. And Matilda's daughter. So that would the word daughter actually comes from Scandinavian for female child of, and that would be your surname. So you would be Agneta, you know, Jan's daughter. So that's where it would come from, for example.
What's your dad's name again, Gareth?
Rory.
Rory. So
I would have been Rorison if I were Scandinavian. Yeah.
Bible.
And then they're obviously in Ireland, they have different things as well. The French had a very different system. But mostly it had to do with either geography or a bit of parentage. But surnames absolutely weren't a thing before like the 1600s.
What? So I'd be Johannesson.
Yeah.
Because my dad's name is Johannes.
Then you would have been Mash Johannesson.
Oh, I love that.
No, if you're a Viking.
Yo, that is crazy. But yeah, I recently discovered this and I was so shocked. It literally blew my mind.
That's why when people say to me like, oh, I've gone into the family history and I've discovered that the cliffs come from. You're like, but they wouldn't have been calling themselves that.
Yeah.
In 1400. They wouldn't have been saying, my name is John Cliff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
They would have said, I'm John of Gloucester.
Certainly, yeah. I also shared a video as well with James there for this, describing this and also kind of elaborating further on how this came, how surnames came to being. Yeah, it's very interesting.
Okay, let's take a look.
So interesting.
Did you know that the Black Death is the reason we have surnames? Like, they existed before that. Actually, the Normans brought them over, but they were mostly for rich people who wanted to show off who they were descended from. If you're a peasant who's just going to live in the same village your whole life, you don't need a surname. You know, if there are two people called John in your village, you can just say, well, you know, John Ilbert's son, or that's John from Westcote. He doesn't need to pass that down to his son. Right. But after the Black Death, there's not enough people to work the land anymore. So to stop the harvest rotting in the fields, the landowners get desperate and they say, look, I know that you've been bound to that land and that manor for hundreds of years, your father before you, but if you break your bond and come over here, I will pay you twice as much. So people start moving around more for work, and now it's much more common that you're going to need to distinguish yourself from other people with the same name. Hence, by 1400, pretty much everyone in England has a surname.
Can you imagine?
Peasants. It's only peasants then. If you're a peasant who works the land, then you didn't have a surname before 1400, okay? Sorry.
Yeah.
you were running around like doing the hard work.
Yes.
Digging holes, pick and shovel, planting harvests, pulling the food out of the ground.
Yeah, so if your ancestors were rich, then it's easier to identify your family history and see like where you came from, etc. But if you can't really, well, climb down that family tree, it means your family was poor.
They were peasants.
Yo, I thought that was insane. I was like, what? But then how does that relate to South Africa then? Because surnames also probably most likely not a thing here either. But then you hear stories about Shaka Zulu.
Yeah.
Zulu is a surname,
right.
Is it not?
But he was called Shaka Kasezangakona, right?
Oh.
You've heard that before.
No.
Yeah.
What?
And Dingaan Kasezangakona.
Yeah.
Because Sezangakona was the father of.
Oh.
Yeah. Even with King, the new king now.
Yes.
Amiso Zulu.
Yes.
Ka Zweletini. Ka Zweletini. Right? So that's also same thing as son of.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. So son of.
Correct.
That is crazy.
Snai says, I am a great, great, great granddaughter of Shaka. My surname is Zulu. No. because he didn't have any children. So you can't.
Oh, yes.
But you can be, I mean, Zulu is also a surname.
Yeah. Very common.
And, yeah. And so it was basically the Zulus and the Mtetwas in the beginning.
Yes.
Who were the most powerful families.
Oh, Simphiwe's family as well. Yeah.
Simphiwe's family, correct.
What?
Yeah. And the Mtetwas were the original, like, powerful family. And then the Zulu took over.
Oh,
the actual Zulu family inside the Zulu tribe.
Yo.
So, yes, Snai, you've got some interesting ancestors, whether you like it or not. Sure. Okay, here's an interesting thing while we're talking about ancestors. I put this up on my Instagram yesterday. It got a lot of reactions, so I thought I'd share it with you. You've got to think about where you come from, and you've got to think about how bizarre the chances are of you even existing. All right? Because remember, each of the people in your family tree had to have sex at exactly the right time. The right sperm had to reach. Mm-hmm. That egg at the right time, they shouldn't have died or been killed or had diseases or anything else.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you wouldn't exist. So the chances of you existing are tiny. Mm-hmm. As I've said before, I think you could have won the lotto 50 times in a row and it wouldn't have been as lucky as you being alive on Earth right now. So you have already won 50 lottos just by being alive. So when people say to me, I'm having such a hard day, I'm like, you are the lotto winner of all lotto winners, and you're complaining about the traffic or the weather or your hairstyle. Stop it. Look at this.
For you to be born required you to have two parents, four grandparents, eight great-grandparents, 16 great-great-grandparents. In fact, if you go back only 10 generations, it took 4,096 ancestors for you to be here watching this today. That's 4,096 people who struggled, survived, loved, fought, won, lost, cried, and cheered. Your ancestors would have faced unbelievable adversity, collapses of governments and countries, world wars, starvation, extreme poverty, nasty diseases that there was no cure for, and so much more. Yet here we are, complaining about how hard it is at a time where it has never been easier to be healthy, wealthy, and thrive. Imagine telling your great-great-grandfather how difficult your day was today. Your hardest day would be easier than the majority of his best days. You today live the life that your ancestors would have prayed for.
Isn't that true?
That is so true.
So if you're feeling a little ungrateful today, I hope that gives you a bit of perspective.
Yeah, that is absolutely incredible. Mm. And if you're feeling unimportant, just stop your car in the middle of traffic.
I feel like, you know, we complain about stuff and then we think, like, the very easiest thing for you would have been impossible for your ancestors to achieve.
Certainly.
You think about the fact that you can chat GPT now. You can use the entire knowledge of the internet to help you put something together.
Let alone a smartphone.
All on that. Yeah. I mean, the little things, hot water, electricity, being able to wear clothes instead of have to make your own clothes out of, I don't know, initially it would have been out of the actual wool of sheep, and then eventually you would have bought the fabric, but you'd still have to make your own stuff. We have shops now. Mm. You don't have to farm your own groceries.
Sure.
Huh?
Actually, I have a neighbor who has, I think he has anger issues.
Anger issues?
Yeah, because whenever there's no water or something, he gets so upset, like visibly upset, physically. He's like, God damn it.
And he makes a noise right next door. Such a noise that you can hear it.
He's that dramatic.
Wow.
Yeah. So I always see him in the passages, and he's always working on his car downstairs. And then, of course, like, I'd get home, I'd be like, oh, do you have water today? I got a notification on our app. Do you have electricity? Then he'd be like, damn it, man. There's no electricity. There's been no electricity since 9 a.m. Damn it. He gets so upset. He complains about having to walk down, because in my complex, we actually have reserve water tanks. So when there's no water in the area, there's reserve tanks that last us about a day and a half, maybe 2 days. But if those reserve tanks dry up, then you have to walk down and go to the truck at the entrance of the complex. He'll complain about having to go get water in a bucket. Like, God damn it. Damn it. It's like we're living in the Stone Age.
So he's,
damn it.
He's angry. He's angry.
He gets so upset, like visually upset. And I'm like, hey, dude, just get water. Go home, boil it. It's not that much of a slip of an inconvenience. it's just so weird to see people get that upset. And it's because we've gotten so comfortable with having everything.
But just going back to the surnames that you brought up earlier. Yeah. So Slippery Pickle says, my brother's friend was known in his youth as Big Chief Shitting Bull. Okay, not Sitting Bull, Shitting Bull. There was no toilet that he could not jam.
No way. That is so embarrassing. Actually, reminds me of a story I heard. I read this on Reddit. There's a guy on Reddit who said that his family has always had a knife that they use in the toilet. They call it the
oh my God, knife. A knife.
Yeah, because everybody in the family clogs up the toilet. So they have a knife that they keep in the bathroom that they call a poop knife.
The poop knife.
So as he grew up with this being normal. So keep in mind that in our household, there's a toilet plunger, there's a toilet brush. They have a toilet plunger, toilet brush, and then a toilet knife, a poop knife. And he grew up thinking this is normal until he actually went to a party. And he got to this party and he clogged up the toilet. I don't know how the hell they just clogged
that whole family must produce enormous turds.
They must be so huge.
Big, thick ones.
Yeah. And he opens the door. He's like, hey, call someone at the party. He's like, can you please give me the poop knife? And someone's like, excuse me? He's like, the poop knife. Don't you guys have a poop knife? Because to him, that's normal. That's what he's used to.
Good Lord, that is revolting.
Yeah. Everybody, they threw him out. But yeah. They
unbelievable. Wow.
Yeah. It's crazy.
So Marco says, I'm like a pot of biryani. I'm Polish, Irish, Dutch, and Khoisan.
Hey.
Now, that's an interesting mix.
Hey, bro.
No, but the point isn't necessarily who those ancestors were, because they might have been good or bad people. Who knows, right?
Certainly.
Might have been very smart people. They might have been peasants.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. But the fact is, you are here because they had sex at just the right time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Every single one of them. 4,000 people going back 10 generations. I mean, the mathematics here is amazing. Mm. I did this as a bit of an exercise once.
Okay.
Long before I saw that video. And it is incredible. So you want to know, I call it generational shift. So
yeah,
I did a quick calculation. If you go back to, let's say, your 10 great-grandparents.
Okay.
That'll put you in 1620. That's 4,096 people.
Okay?
So that's the 10 generations they were talking about. If you go back even further, let's say you go back 20 great-grandparents. 1320 is the year.
Mm.
Okay, so in the year 1320, do you know how many people it takes to make you?
How many?
In 1320, there needed to be 4,130,304 people.
What?
Now, the fact is, there weren't that many people around in those days. So that means that you are inbred in some way. Like, there's definitely, like, you know, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh cousins that would have met without knowing that they were related in 1320.
Whoa.
So it becomes really complicated. As you go even further back, so let's say you go to the year 990.
Okay.
So a thousand years ago, roughly.
Yes.
You're now talking about 31 great-grandparents. You're talking about 8,458,862,592 people.
What?
That would have made you. But of course, there weren't 8 billion people on Earth at that stage. So it means that you are actually inbred.
Yeah.
I mean, not inbred. Inbred would be cousins. But you are related to every other person from that area, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
And that just shows you again how all of the stuff about ancestry is fine. But in the end, we're all kind of related.
Yes, we are.
Certainly if you have, you know, Western European heritage, you're related to, if you have Central African heritage, you will be related to people across the board. So these are things that I think we take too personally, we take too seriously.
Mm.
It's not actually important.
The amazing thing is
that you're here.
Yes. I've never actually thought of it that way, that it takes so many, that I am the result and product of so many people's lived experiences. These weren't just people who just mated and then died.
Mm-hmm.
They had lives, they had personalities, that
they were they were at war, they were enslaved, they were on ships, they were worked to death. They diseases that like stupid stuff. You'd cut yourself and you would die of an infection. You'd die. You know, because they didn't have antibiotics. And these people survived. So you are the product of winners. Even the biggest loser that you know is a product of winners.
Certainly.
Right?
Now I want to see how I wish I could be around to see how things pan out in the next 1,000 years. Because keep in mind that once we're gone, we now live in a generation where we document everything. We have Instagrams, we have pictures, we have cameras at our beck and call. We have all these things available to us immediately. Now, 10 generations from now, let's start it slow.
Sure.
It's going to be crazy for them because now we have actual documentation. But look, there's your great grandfather wearing a spandex suit at Comic Con.
Absolutely.
Yo, I can't.
It's amazing.
That's crazy.
Hey, while we're talking about crazy, this is quite a fun story. Not for the guy in question, though.
Yeah.
Duma Kantlovu, who's a filmmaker and producer, is set to appear in court to face charges of fraud and tax evasion.
Ooh.
So apparently he and his co-accused, Rodney Mucharini and Maxwell Mloyi, appeared in court yesterday, postponed to Tuesday. Kantlovu allegedly made representations in his income and corporate tax of 25 million rand that SARS say he owes them.
Here?
25 million rand. So SARS said this guy hasn't filed his taxes properly. He owes us 25 million rand. So he could get up to 2 years in prison for lying to SARS. So Mash and I were thinking, 2 years is not so bad.
2 years is not that bad.
I mean, prison's terrible. Mm. You don't want to go to a South African prison. Mm. But for 2 years, if he gets to keep the 25 million, for those 2 years, it'll gain some interest. It'll probably get to about 30.
But the thing is, that's maybe if he 35. Has the 25 million.
Yeah, he hasn't given it away.
To SARS. You know, one thing I've learned is that people are so misinformed about SARS, about tax.
Mm.
And tax is so simple. I've been filing my own taxes for the past 3 years, and I learned that it is so simple. It's literally copy paste. You just copy the code, the amount in the that matches the code, and that's it. That's all it takes on your IRP 5. And we just complicate it because it's something foreign to us. We were never educated about it. So we think of it
but
as
they don't teach you that at school.
Yes.
Isn't it the weirdest thing is they don't teach you about tax and insurance and stuff that you actually need to know at school.
Yeah, how to use an ATM. That's the things
basic
we need to
stuff.
Learn. Those are the basics of life.
Interest. No one teaches you about interest at school.
My ex actually bought a quite expensive car at with a variable interest rate.
Yeah.
And then he was telling me that like when I bought the car like 5 years ago, it was like I was paying like 7 grand. I'm now paying 13 grand. And I was like, you know, if you got fixed interest, you'd probably be paying 10 grand and would have just stayed there.
Yeah.
Yes, you're going to pay higher, but you also have to, like, these are things that we have to teach ourselves and learn because nobody will teach them to us, unfortunately. We have to learn them the hard way.
So Mapelo says, Duma Ntlovu is the best. Well, we're the best at what? Not paying his taxes. Yo.
But how do you get to 25 million, Gareth? How do you get to such a high amount? Because keep in mind that SARS sends me reminders to file my tax.
Exactly.
They send me threats of if I haven't filed by like a certain date. There's so many things.
We know how like SARS is the one government department that really does work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they know what they're doing.
Thanks to Pravin, partially.
Partly Pravin. But it's definitely thanks to Tom Moyane.
Oh,
he
certainly.
Was fantastic.
Tom Moyane was
the he was the greatest. We need more of him. Instead of learning about that stuff, they teach you algebra because we use that every day.
Hi,
Of course. I mean, it is kind of crazy that we don't learn about the stuff at school.
It is sad, actually. It's really sad because nobody knows nothing about. I have a colleague, actually, who hasn't filed these taxes ever. And I was like, hey, Bowen, how are you living life? And the thing is, when you're an employee, you're actually going to get returned.
It can be very, very scary for that guy when they eventually come knocking.
Yours is going to be terrifying.
Because then
terrifying.
They're going to say to him, all that money over the last, 10 years?
Yeah, certainly. And you know what's the saddest part is that when I first filed my taxes 3 years ago, I was scared because like, oh, how much do I owe these people? Oh, no, does it work? Oh. But I learned how to do it. and I actually got money. And since then, I've just been getting money and getting money. And I'm like, some people are actually...
Well, it is your money.
It is my money that they're giving back to me. So it makes me think to myself that, okay, so you are just letting go of all this money. How much money have you let go of by not filing your taxes? How much money that is yours? And also, what happens to the money if you just never get it back?
That's exactly right.
Does it go to, what, hospitals? And no,
they steal it mostly.
So your money is being stolen because you're not taking it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That is crazy.
Just learn about this stuff because they're not going to teach you. You have to you have to do your own education when it comes to your taxes, health insurance.
Certainly.
All those things. No one's going to help you with that. Learn about interest rates. It'll help you not be impoverished later on.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to meet somebody in a second who's doing something really, really cool that I think we should know about. And he's in the country, doesn't live here all the time, but he has a profound interest in South Africa and wants to help make this place great. Justin van Breda is a prolific interior and furniture designer. His projects have been created using a skill that was learnt at the right hand of Nikki Haslam. You may know that name. And honed over the last 20 years. Now, his passion for creating considered, interesting, and curated interiors made him a sought-after designer in the industry. You may be familiar with Justin from Breda, and he's going to be telling us a little bit about his project, the Cape Craft School, this morning. We talk about the things we should be learning. These are skills that we should be learning. Justin, nice to see you. How are you?
I'm great, Gareth. How are you?
Yeah, good. And
thanks
you're
for
only
having me.
You're back in South Africa for a little bit?
I'm here for 10 days.
Right.
I'm in sort of in the middle of 10 days.
Yeah, and you spend a bit of time here, but not often.
Increasingly so.
Yeah.
I've just sent a container of furniture to South Africa, which my mother's like, are you moving back? And I'm like, we'll see. When the school is set up and the demands of my time are kind of worked out, then I think I'll know where I'm at.
Furniture is a very, very difficult business. You have to know what you're doing. You have to be on top of trends and make sure that you're aware of what people actually want to spend money on. It is expensive for people. You know, they have to furnish their houses. Some people are very particular about that. Certainly your stuff isn't like your run-of-the-mill, off-the-peg kind of furniture. And as a result, you've become a master in this field. You've understood this in a way that probably most of us will, as consumers, never understand it. And I'm sure that there are things that you can tell us about the furniture business, but you've done extraordinarily well over the years. And I mean, it's now a booming business. You want to give back. We'll get to that in a second. Tell us about the business.
Well, it's been a hell of a learning curve, I'd say, over the last 20 odd years. And it's kind of quite organic because you do, as you said, you run with what your clients want and what your clients say. And I've been very privileged. I've been very, very privileged to have clients who've in a way been like patrons.
Mm-hmm.
There's you know, one client who I've did an enormous amount of work for who inspired a whole collection of furniture.
Wow.
And that sent the company in a certain direction, which has been amazing. And you know, I've worked bits in South Africa, I've worked quite a lot in the US and obviously the UK. But I think when you start your career, which I did very, very luckily with Nikki, who is everything that you read about. I mean,
so just for people who don't know anything about Nikki Haslam, just tell us about him.
So Nikki spans three centuries. His mother was the goddaughter of Queen Victoria. So I always think your life sort of begins with your mother's life, your kind of your whole lineage and heritage. So he kind of goes from 1897 and he's still alive. He's this week he turned 85.
Wow.
And he's still designing, he's still working. And
incredible.
I started as his sidekick. And I ended up as creative director there. And it sort of set me on a course. I mean, he taught me how to say English phrases that I had absolutely no idea as this boy from South Africa. You know,
like,
things like Kadugan.
How to pronounce these things.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
And, you know, he would drive through London and go, well, that's the window they hung Charles the First's head out of after they beheaded him. And you're like, okay, and that's the last church by Inigo Jones. And it was this incredible sort of like post-grad in design.
Wow.
Which was amazing. And then I went on and opened a shop on the Pimlico Road in London in 2002, which was fantastic. And it was a little dream. And every single thing in my shop came from South Africa.
Sure.
I wanted to sort of showcase the very best that South Africa could produce. And, you know, what you don't know doesn't matter really, because I knew absolutely zero. You know, I had no idea what to do with money when clients paid. Nobody wanted to give me a shop because I was a South African boy in London. I was 26 years old. It was kind of crazy, wow. But it was wild and it was enormous amounts of fun. And I had incredible people who I still work with today, in different aspects of my life, who are South African on the South African design scene, who I still work today, 25 years later. You know, people like Greg Mello, who's a great designer in South Africa today, Sarah Heinemann, who's a sculptor. They all helped me open that shop.
That's incredible. Are people in the UK aware of South African design? Is it something that had its heyday already? Is it something that's on the up and up?
No, I think South African interior design followed the Australian model. So Vogue Living did its whole own thing. It broke away from the whole kind of interiors model, did its own thing. And South Africa followed that really quickly about 30 years ago. And so developed their own style, which, because of the way people are living today, that whole formal way is falling apart and people are looking towards kind of places like Australia and South Africa for a kind of a lifestyle component. And I mean,
do we have a look? Do we have a particular kind of aesthetic appeal in the UK?
It's very much that indoor, outdoor, open living vibe. There's a very successful brand called Hadidar, which in England they call Hadida, which is all stuff from Africa online. The couple who run it live in Cape Town, and it's all South African stuff online. And then, I mean, he'll kill me for saying this, but Greg Miller won the International Interior Designer of the Year Award through Andrew Martin last year, and he's a South African interior designer based in Cape Town.
Oh, that's wow. I mean, that's amazing.
There's huge talent in this country.
Okay, that makes me feel good. I think it's important because Carl says here, can you please ask Justin what he thinks of the terrible Mr. Price couch you have him sitting on? So yes, I mean, this is our lovely set furniture, but yeah. I'm sure you...
You know, there's a place for everything. Yeah. And frankly...
That's such a diplomatic answer. No, but
frankly, I actually think Mr. Price does an amazing job.
Really?
Yeah. I think they hit the market in the right place. They've they've taken, in certain elements, they've taken sort of what's custom or bespoke design or high-end design, and they've distilled it through things like shower curtains and platters and stuff and put those designs onto those items and made it accessible to people.
Yes. Right, and affordable.
Yeah, which is what it's all about, because you know you can live in that whole world where everything's bespoke, but it gets quite boring. You know, when nothing's available to anybody because it's all so expensive and it's all at the top of the market and it's all kind of, you know, very precious. And I quite like to mix it up.
And very, very rich people spend their entire day thinking about how they can upgrade all of the things that they use on a daily basis. So their furniture, the pictures in their house, the car that they drive or have or get driven around in, the clothes they wear. And it becomes just a big war of outbidding the people who are in your same social...
It can be. But also on the other side of the coin, they can get sick of it. They can get sick of being hit up for money. They can get sick of, you know, constant pressure from their crew of people, like their designers and their garden people and their architects, to constantly be upgrading. I recently had an incredible weekend in Athens with wonderful, wonderful clients who I've done probably about 5 houses for them over the years. And I hadn't seen them much since COVID. And it was his birthday and they had a big party. And we'd done this house in Athens about 10 years ago. And the last time I'd been there was to hang the lighting. And I got there, my client said, Justin, we're camping. You know, we've never really moved in because their kids went to university and they ended up living somewhere else in the UK. And it was really refreshing that they were just, you know, enjoying the space without being too precious about, like, you know, are the curtains up yet? And, the library's not finished. And she said to me, you know, Justin, I've still got your drawings. I pulled them last week because we've spent 3 months here and actually we're going to now do the library. And I did the drawings 10 years ago. And that's actually really quite refreshing for people.
That's cool.
Just they're living, you know. And I think that's sometimes that the, you know, people at a certain level have a crew of people who support them. And they can get quite fatigued by the pressure from the people to keep doing stuff.
And especially if you've got more than one house.
Yeah. Right. And one of my favorite clients who's been a client of mine for, since I was at Nikki's, she's one of my favorite clients of all time. We installed her new kitchen last week, and her home got flooded in the flash floods in London.
Oh, shit.
She woke up to a meter of water, entire house underwater, and it was devastating. And the first thing she said to me is, my dogs are alive.
It's That's all she cared about.
My dogs are alive.
All the other stuff I'm
fine.
Didn't matter.
I'm finding the nearest party, the nearest bottle of vodka, I'm off. See you later. You know, she's like, my dogs are alive and we're okay. And that's important.
Slippery Pickle says in the comments, it's become so expensive for Indonesian slaves to craft a table and then to get it into your home these days.
Well, then don't buy something from Indonesia. Buy something handmade in Africa.
There we go. Mm. All right. So let's talk about what you're doing with the Cape Craft School. Because this is, I think, very cool. It's going to create opportunities for talented young South Africans who have, and we need skills development. We don't need more degrees. We don't need people studying law and history and languages and all that stuff. It's very important, but we don't need more of them. What we need is people who have skills, because some of these skills are not going to be replicable by machine. You know, the kinds of things that if you make a tapestry, to weave it by hand. There are machines that can do it, but it'll never look as good.
Yeah, I mean, there is a... This idea is a distillation of a lot of inspiration from a lot of fantastic people. So there's somebody who had a small foundation in Cape Town called Pay It Forward. And when I was talking to her about this idea that I had, she was like, yeah, okay. And then I was like, you're just saying okay. And she was like, you haven't finished the circle. Complete the circle. And I was like, penny dropped.
Yeah.
Another gentleman who runs a wonderful charity who is going to be getting involved with the sending children from their creative programs into the school said to me, so what are you going to do with the kids during the school holidays? And I was like,
I haven't thought about it.
What do you mean? Yeah. And he was like, Justin, these kids don't go to Hermanus. You know, you're dealing with kids who they need to be occupied during the school holidays. There's an enormous amount of safeguarding that we need to put in place. And that was an aha moment for me.
You have to think about their whole
It's life. A holistic yeah. approach. And that has been very, very inspiring. And so just to the whole thing kind of distilled into this idea, I was sitting with a client in Boston presenting my rug collection, which is all handmade by lovely women in Cape Town out of mohair, which is something, it was a bit of a lockdown project. Mm-hmm. I said to my mother, you know, I know this community of women and there's no work for them. And I think we can do something. And I think my mother thought I was saying, let's maybe do some food packages.
Yeah.
And I was like, let's build looms. Let's make great big looms.
Wow.
So we did. We commissioned these looms.
That's already going.
Yeah, we did that in 2021. So we've been weaving for 2.5 years. We commissioned these big looms in India. We brought them to Cape Town. It turns out I've got cousins who farm in mohair. And I've got an 101-year-old aunt who started with 3 goats and now 6,000 goats.
101-year-old aunt.
Auntie Wendy. She lives with my second cousin, Roland, who's her grandson, on a farm called Barkensroch in outside Beaufort West. And she is, according to Mohair South Africa, who I had a wonderful meeting with earlier this year, she is renowned for really starting the Angora goat farming for mohair in this country. I didn't know that. Sure. I just knew that Auntie Wendy had some goats. She's got like 3,000 head of goats or something.
That's amazing. She's probably the biggest supplier in the world.
And I went to see her and she's amazing. But you know, 80% of the world's mohair, that I should get off my soapbox, but about 80% of the world's mohair is farmed in this country. And almost 80% of it leaves this country as a greasy fleece. We don't process it. We don't clean it.
You see.
And there's an incredible workshop in a spinning mill and weaving mill in... the Eastern Cape called Hinterfeld, who I'm doing some work with. And they have an entire wool cleaning plant that stands still because all of our greasy wool goes to China to be processed. They still process and clean and spin mohair. They spin it, they clean it, they spin it into the most beautiful yarns, and they create the most incredible
textiles. And mohair, just to explain to people, this is the softest, most desirable hair for producing things like rugs.
It is. Mohair is a very strong fiber.
And clothes.
It saturates color very beautifully.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's a hair, and it comes from the Angora goat.
Yes.
And we mix it with wool, which obviously comes from sheep. And we get the raw materials. And it becomes a bit like cotton wool.
Mm-hmm.
And we spin it by hand on these little spinners that have a tiny little sort of sewing machine engine.
Yeah.
And our ladies, there's a rhythm to spinning. Spinning is an art form because there's a rhythm to creating the tension and the movement in the yarn, which then creates the movement in what you're making.
Right.
So we spin the yarn. There's a small workshop in Cape Town who dyes it for us if we want color to it.
Yeah.
And then we weave it all by hand. in Cape Town.
So just explain with the Cape Craft School. So are these kids who haven't got much of a kind of career path ahead of them? They don't have the opportunities that maybe kids in a city would have. And you teach them these skills, or they have a natural talent for these skills. You obviously try to create a route to employment for them. How does it work exactly?
So our goal is 200 kids a year. We'll obviously start a little smaller, but we want to try and offer creative young learners who are finishing high school, for whom there is very little creative opportunity in this country, mm-hmm. for a tertiary type of education, yeah. or support.
Yes.
And then, in, as my friend said, close the circle, give them a route to market.
Yeah.
So the idea is that we will educate them, teach them a heritage skill, weaving, spinning, sculpture, carving, furniture making.
Incredible.
So usable skills.
Yeah.
And then complete the circle to give them a route to market. So I've been very privileged in my career to have access to this incredible international design community.
Mm.
And the idea is to really leverage that to expose a platform for these, for the work. And I've just been to the incredible, I mean, unbelievable Homo Faber exhibition in Venice,
yeah.
which curated, it is a craft platform. Homo Faber, obviously meaning handmade or man-made. The most inspiring stuff.
What kind of stuff do they have there?
Everything from embroidery to carved things to jewelry to flower making, like paper flowers and ceramic flowers.
I often think about stuff that's been made that's in museums that people were able to fashion out of the original raw materials 100, 200, 500 years ago. And you think, I wonder if we still have that skill.
Exactly.
And just and these like are that, the people
made
who
this year.
Oh, wow.
So cut glass and blown glass and
sure.
just incredible stuff. And I walked out of that exhibition and I thought, right, let's create the Center for Man-Made Craft in South Africa at that level. That the stuff, and I know it won't happen on the first day,
yes.
but let's create something that aspires to be that level, that anything coming out of our organization can sit on a table with the stuff from that place. And that was hugely inspiring.
Someone being funny here in the comments, Carl says, is weaving a heritage skill.
Might well be.
How very funny. Gavin says, I know a few Angora bookies. I think maybe Gavin's not talking about the actual Angora goats there. So who are these people going to be? Is it in the Cape only?
And so our school is going to be in Cape Town, but we're trying to make it, it's that thing of the individual and the institution. So we're setting up an institution that we want to have succeed so that we can
build it and they will come.
Well, and make right. and make the institution as successful as it can be so that we educate as many of these young people as we can. So the idea is disadvantaged young learners, creative learners that will be sponsored through the program.
Right.
And we are pairing up with, at the moment, with three organizations who will feed kids into the school. So we're speaking to Africa Tikkun, who run right. creative programs.
Terrific people.
Yeah, they're fantastic. And they run creative programs for their young learners. And when they finish matric, there's very little for these kids to go on to do.
Right.
So they are going to identify and feed kids through into our program. Then Imibala Trust, which has four campuses, one based in Somerset West, one in Amanus, one in Graaff-Reinet, mm-hmm. and one in Mariesburg, which they're busy setting up.
Yeah.
They run these incredible programs for really, really disadvantaged and street children as they're going through school. They've done over 87,000 school uniforms in the last 3 years, which is an incredible leveler.
It's insane.
And the little child walks into the shop and rings the bell and gets served. And sometimes it's their first pair of shoes, from sanitary pads for the young girls to pencil cases. And sort of, you remember those old scientific calculators that I could never use mine.
Yes.
They still use them in school, terrifyingly. And they can be sponsored as part of the school uniform. And they really just give such dignity to these people. And they... And they're going to identify kids to come through the program. And then there's Melon Educate, which is an Irish charity that mm-hmm. for many years, I mean, now Melon actually started the RDP housing program out of Nelson Mandela's office, having done something
incredible in
Mizama Yetu in Harp Bay.
Right.
Then he went into education, and they have 14 schools in Cape Town that we are going to be introduced to their headmasters to identify creative kids to come into the craft school. Mm-hmm. So it's They're going to finish high school, 18 to 21. We're going to have a residential aspect to it, which is a new thing. Like I said, everybody inspires something. So that kids from out of Cape Town can come and, you know, be in like a Corsairs type of environment, and come to the school. And then we want to teach them regarding their attitudes. So they're creative kids. They've maybe done art from a trick, or they've got a creative kind of aspect to them. Mm-hmm. We'll identify which crafts they have an affiliation to, teach them that craft. But we're also going to teach them sort of small business admin stuff.
Right. So that they the stuff we were just talking about before you came in.
So they understand why you must save and why you must plan and program. Mm. And so that'll run throughout the year. Mm. There will also be sort of, which was an idea by my cousin. My cousin Kenny runs he's in finance. And I was talking to him about this because it's a free education.
Right.
How do you wipe out the culture of expectation? And he said, well, how about if you gave, so then this is the idea, to give the kids when they start a balance in like what we're going to call a college currency. And they will spend that on their transport and they will spend that at the materials library.
Right.
And so they'll see their balance go up and down, and then they will be credited if they do outstanding work or volunteer or help another student. And they will be debited if they're truant or late or disruptive. And then
economy within the economy.
Exactly. Yes. And that will then run concurrently with their business admin stuff. And then that will turn into real-time money at the end of every term. So that they've got something to spend during their holidays.
You've thought about so much of what will make this work.
There's a lot we haven't thought about.
But what kind of inspires you, and where did the idea to go into the business that you're in now? Where did that come from when you were young? If you cast your mind back, how did it all start for you in terms of this is what I want to do? Because people always have 1,000 dreams and 1,000 ambitions. And to actually distill that and figure out, like, this is the niche that I can do the best.
I was that kid. I was going to go into politics, and I was going to be a journalist. I was going to write the great novel. I was going to, you know, I studied for 6 years. And for me, the answer came walking through the doors of a school called Design Time in Cape Town. And it's run by a woman who's going to be sitting on the board of the college called Yolande Mitten. She's the founder. She is one of the most inspiring women I've ever met. Mm-hmm. And she changed my life. I thought I wanted to be an architect. I had no idea what the realm of design really was. Mm. And in those days, we weren't that exposed. There was no internet. There was there was no Instagram. I mean, Instagram was like 15 years away, you know, when I went there in 1997. Ooh. And we drafted everything by hand. We didn't even draw a computer. and I walked into that school and it was the most nurturing place, and it still is that I've ever it changed my life. And if I can create something that is just a little bit as inspiring as what she does every single day and has done for the last 30 years, then the school can only but triumph, because she has inspired an entire generation of young designers.
Brilliant. I love that. What a great story.
So if we can do that for young people, it'll be amazing.
I think this is terrific.
And we'll have pitfalls and triumphs, I'm sure.
Yes. No, nothing specific.
And there's a lot we haven't thought about. I mean, we thought about a lot, and we keep thinking about a lot. And I have some wonderful people who've sort of landed on my shoulder, like guardian angels, who are going to be sitting on my board and helping me work. And it's incredible. So, you know, we have an event tonight, which is hosted by a guy who was my best friend at pre-prep. We met at the age, he was 4 and I was 5. And as his wife would say, they just never stopped talking. And he, and 6 months ago, he said, I want to help with this, you know? And a great friend of mine from university has come on board to project manage and pull the whole thing together in Cape Town. And so I'm working with people who I've known for so long.
Superb.
And my uncle is our lawyer, and it's just this incredible kind of,
great.
Yeah, and then there's some other wonderful people who've just been, I call him my angel. He's like, just land on my shoulder. He's amazing.
I had a conversation with someone a while ago, and we were talking about whether or not you should work with friends or family. And I've had a complete 180 degree turn on this, because it used to be, I used to think, oh no, don't, because if it goes wrong, you know, you're going to have a terrible relationship or whatever. And the reality is, if it goes right, you can both, if it's 2 people, 3 people, 4 people, you can all triumph together. and you can change things together. You can make other people's lives better, and the it multiplies. It seems exponentially valuable when you're doing it with people that you know and trust and care about. Well, the rewards are just incredible.
There's the flip side of that. You know, they don't take your shit.
Yeah, that's also true. Yeah.
Like right. Dawn calls me on it. Dawn goes, no. And Dawn will phone me, she says, Justin, you need to do this. I read between the lines. You need to do this today.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, and she'll go, yes, today. And so that's amazing. but I come from a couple, my father and his brother were best friends and business partners for 40 years.
See.
And I'd go to war behind my brother.
Yeah.
And so
say your surname in England?
Van Breeder.
Van Breeder.
Yeah, it's terribly irritating. But I end up saying it when I phone a call center and I've got to get through to like British Telecom, and I'll go Van Breeder because it's just, Van Breeder doesn't really.
No, yeah, they don't know how to say it.
Doesn't really do it, yeah.
I love it. Brian says, I listen from the UK every day, usually on Spotify, but today's my first day watching on YouTube. Really cool to see the comments. Hi, everyone. And lots of comments here about you. And how great this idea is. Heritage skills, it's just unbelievable. So I think people are into it. I think this is amazing.
There's been a groundswell of support from it. And I will tell you something that has been amazing is when the whole philanthropy world is very new to me. And when this idea literally popped into my head, and I was sitting with a client in Boston, and she was like, okay, so you've done the weaving project with the carpets. Mm. We'd done a furniture collection with blind cane weavers. And what's next? And I said, a school. And I was like, who's pulling the puppet strings? It was literally that kind of aha moment. And the idea wouldn't let me go. But I had been pondering. My partner had said to me a few months before that he'd listened to this incredible podcast on the sense of purpose.
Yeah.
And how people bleat on about how happy they've got to be. And, you know, happiness, happiness, happiness. But if you have a sense of purpose, things will follow. And I had been pondering that. And when he said that to me, I thought, there's more to my life than selling sideboards. And I don't mean at all to underrate diminish my industry. And I love my work and I love working. Yeah. And it's kind of a crazy pace, particularly right now. But I did think there's more. And so I had really opened this gap in my head for something. And this idea popped in and it literally took hold. And my life has done a complete 180. A year ago, if I'd been sitting in this chair with you, I would never have said that I was considering partially living back in South Africa. And it's the sense of purpose has sort of taken over my life. And I don't have kids, and I don't have this incredible sense of like I've got to leave a legacy behind.
Yeah.
But I do feel that I can make a difference. And I love young people. In fact, I love people. I love people and I like working. So it's and you know, South Africa.
Do your bit.
The thing about South Africa, and I lived out of South Africa, and I was back, you know, because everything in my first shop came from South Africa, so I was backwards and forwards a lot, and I have been backwards and forwards a lot. In fact, trying to find it kind of like when I left date in my passports is kind of a nightmare. But South Africa, you can't get over South Africa.
No, you never get it out of your system.
And to those people who are sitting abroad listening, like, you're not going to get over it. So stop trying because at the end of the day, yeah.
I think that's very, very true. Everyone I've spoken to who's, and some of them are hugely successful like you, and they've been overseas for a long time, but there's something in your blood if you're from here.
Yes, huh? Certainly. Yeah.
Huh.
And you can bring something back. You can bring, and there's a lot of people are, you can bring something back. You can bring your knowledge back. The knowledge that I've gained over the last 25 years, the contacts, the exposure, is invaluable, and it's invaluable to what I'm going to be doing with the school.
Absolutely. But I think it's wonderful.
The school's going to be a special place, I think.
All right, so we will obviously post a bunch of info in the description of the show, but if you want to find out more, we'll have all of that there for you. Justin, it's so nice to meet you again, and to see you this morning, Mash. Thanks for all those unbelievable stories from your life.
Thank you, Gary.
It's been a busy morning. And enjoy the rest of your Wednesday. We are in October already, so there's plenty to do, people to see, places to go. We will see you on Friday morning, 6 o'clock, bright and early, right here.